Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin. A little later, the governor of the state of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, will be joining us. Matt Hall, the chair of the Select Legislative Committee overseeing the COVID-19 response. And Republican consultant Scott Hagerstrom, who's not happy that a federal judge has left in place an order that will allow congressional candidates to file later for their campaigns and also allow them to file electronic signatures, which is a novel concept here in Michigan. But first, a look ahead to this week, the last week of the governor's current emergency declaration that she's been using to issue these emergency orders that allow her to suspend state laws temporarily during this COVID-19 crisis. The hope was that the governor would be able to work with the Republican-led legislature to get another 28-day extension, which is allowed under the 1976 law that governs these types of emergencies. But the prospects are not likely. As you'll hear from the governor later, she is ready to issue a new emergency executive order and roll her previous ones into that one as a go-around if she's concerned the legislature isn't interested in working with her. The trust is faltering on both sides. Republican legislators are hearing from their constituents in mostly rural areas of the state that COVID-19 has touched them little, if at all. They're tired of the stay-home, stay-safe order. They're ready for a more aggressive transition back into normal life, and they're concerned the governor is simply trying to run the state without any meaningful check or balance in perpetuity. They see a governor on national television, a lot. They see a governor who is being mentioned as a potential vice presidential candidate, and wonder if she's using her skills in television interviews to, at the very least, feed questions about President Donald Trump's abilities and decision-making during this pandemic. At worst, make the case for why she should be Joe Biden's Democratic running mate. Their legal team is ready to make the case that the governor does not have the authority to issue overlapping emergency executive directives as a go-around of the legislative branch, and they're prepared to take the matter to court if need be. Meanwhile, the governor sees a legislature, particularly Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey, who has been particularly vocal about her approach on social media. Their relationship has chilled to the point where they have few conversations. And when they do have conversations, they're not good. I asked her in this interview if she trusts the legislature and if they're offering suggestions with the best interests of the residents in mind, or if she thinks there are political motivations at play. You can hear her response to that question, but it's clear there is issues there. As a longtime student of politics, Whitmer must be mindful that the Republican base is putting at least some pressure on Shirkey and House Speaker Lee Chatfield to sow the seeds of discontent so she doesn't become some rising star that will propel Joe Biden to the White House later in November. So instead of talking to the legislature, she's consulting epidemiologists, scientists, and doctors about what should be done to keep the spread of the coronavirus in check. She, too, has her legal team ready to go if the legislature wants to challenge her authority to issue these overlapping emergency declarations, which is conceivably allowed in the state's 1945 Emergency Powers Declaration, which is a reason why the Senate last week voted to try and repeal that very law. Behind the scenes, the Senate Minority Leader, Jim Ananick, has acted as an intermediary as best he can. He's played this role a lot in 2019. In the past, he's done his best to bring people together and hash out their differences. But in this case, it appears the relationship is too broken and the political ramifications too intense that not even the calming, rational approach Jim Ananick can bring to the table is enough to prevent both sides from a constitutional showdown that can only be worked out in court. The Republican legislature will make the argument the best they can that the governor is trying to run the state with no substantial legislative check or balance, while claiming this is government run amok with no real citizen input. The Democrats and the governor will claim the Republicans are playing politics and gum up the governor's desire to protect the lives of the state's most vulnerable residents by keeping in place restrictions that theoretically will prevent an explosive spread of the coronavirus, which would overwhelm hospitals and make more people sick. It's against this backdrop that will bring in the governor of the state of Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
It's a raining all over the world.
Joining us now for the MERS Monday podcast is the governor of the state of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer. Thanks so much for taking a couple minutes with us this morning.
Absolutely.
So take us back to that first moment you heard Michigan had its first positive case of COVID-19. When was it? Where was it? And what went through your mind?
Well, you know, we had prepared the State Emergency Operations Center because we knew, even though we hadn't had a case yet, we were going to get it. It was inevitable. So we stood up the operation, but the first two cases came in on March 10th. I was watching returns from the primary in Michigan that day. I was sitting at the residence. I had a few friends here, and we were watching returns, and the call came in that we'd had our first two positive cases. And so, obviously, I sent everyone home and headed down to the State Emergency Operations Center. And I think, you know, in that moment, it really became clear that life was going to change, and it was kind of a surreal thing. My team pivoted from operations as normal into crisis mode, and that's where we've been ever since. And it's been challenging, and it's been incredibly stressful but also inspirational, because there are people that walk amongst us every single day that you don't realize are really doing incredibly important work that we all rely on them for. And I find inspiration there, when especially when the times are really tough.
So it was in the evening then, on election night.
Yep. I knew that we were processing some tests and they'd all been coming back negative, but that was when I got the phone call that early evening, and that's when we went down to the SCOC and made the announcement a couple hours later.
So Thursday marks the end of your current emergency powers declaration. Do you see yourself crafting a new similar one to Executive Order 42, or asking the legislature to extend that one for a longer period of time?
Well, the source of my authority comes from a number of different places, but I do think that it's important that we have a declared state of emergency, and we're going to have one for quite a while. The fact of the matter is, working with the legislature to extend it is the best way to make sure that we give all of the protections necessary for the nurses and doctors and incredible people that have come back onto the front line to provide health care in this moment. So it is my hope that the legislature continues to extend it, because that's really the mechanism for providing those protections for our frontline health care workers.
But if you don't get the sense that they are, you're prepared to issue a different one like you did with 42.
Correct. I've got, like I said, authority in the executive branch during time of emergency through a number of different sources. And we're going to continue doing the work. I mean, you see across the country that states that are starting to reopen are getting, you know, there's pickets and demonstrations happening there that they should stay closed. I mean, there's no easy solution here. And so what we have to do is look at the science, look at the facts, prepare to open, to re-engage sectors of our economy thoughtfully and in waves. But we got to do the right thing. We have to always do the next right thing. And the next right thing is continuing to monitor the data, ramp up our testing, ramp up our tracing abilities, so that we really feel like we've got a better handle on how fast COVID-19 is in our state, and that we've got the mechanism to keep this curve down. And that's in the best interest of our economy in the long run, as well as obviously the health of our people.
Do you trust that the Senate Majority Leader and the House Speaker are genuinely trying to assist you with their recommendations, or do you fear that their offers are based on purely political motives?
You know, I hate speculating on people's motives. I'll just say that, you know, I've had a lot of great conversations with the Speaker. I'll say that I was hopeful that the Senate Bipartisan Committee would promulgate something. They had a unanimous vote mechanism that they were supposed to, you know, operate with. I don't know if the plug's been pulled completely or why the Senate GOP decided to promulgate something without that committee they created, but I would like to see them go back to that committee and promulgate some unanimous things so that they really take the time to get invested in the data. It's easy to observe and share grievances. The hard work is really digging into the data and doing the rigorous review of the various economic sectors we have with all of the public health overlays and making thoughtful, informed decisions. And that's my job. I'll welcome input from a variety of sources, including, you know, the partisan caucuses, if that's how they, you know, choose to proceed. But at the end of the day, I am doing a much more rigorous process and working with the best public health officials in the world from at the University of Michigan and Dr. Janae Khaldun, as well as some of the greatest thought leaders in business and academia, because we got to get this right.
And then I also want to ask you about your decision to appear on all these national talk shows. How much of your decision to accept those interviews is based on increasing your national exposure to be Biden's running mate?
Zero. Zero.
Okay. Then explain the thinking behind bringing on board Pete Buttigieg's former national press secretary, Chris Megger, on board, if not for the VP prep.
So, the right now we have had to communicate a lot more and a lot more aggressively than ever before. And so we've built out a number of different parts of our operation. We've added some legal capacity. We've added some communications capacity. We've added to our state emergency operations center capacity. We've brought in people from the private sector on loan to help us. I mean, this is all hands on deck. And so the fact that we had someone who was so skilled and connected in communications, who was a Michigander, who was back home and without full-time employment on a campaign, we thought this is the perfect person who can jump in and not miss a beat and can help us amplify the message. Every time I go on TV, whether it's on WDIV in Detroit, Wood TV in Grand Rapids, or the national news, it's an opportunity to educate people about how serious COVID-19 is, and it's another opportunity to ask for help, and it makes a difference. And so I think if people understood that, if I was declining invitations to come on, they would accuse me of a dereliction of duty. I've got to take every opportunity to reinforce how serious this issue is so we can save lives and get people to buy into the importance of this stay-home posture so that we're not spreading COVID-19. And it's an opportunity to highlight what's going on in Michigan, because each time I've done these, we've gotten additional emails from all over or calls. I've got PPE, or I've got a source for PPE. I send all of those to the SCOC, and many times it turns out to be a legitimate opportunity to get N95 masks or gowns for our frontline first responders. So each of these is an opportunity to do more on behalf of the state. My job is to protect the people of Michigan, and I'm going to use every lever that I can to do that. Lives are at stake here.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer, so appreciate your time today on the MERS Money Podcast.
Thanks, Kyle. Stay safe.
Joining me on the other end of the line is the new chair of the COVID-19 Select Committee. His name is Representative Matt Hall, and he's also the chair of the House Oversight Committee. How are you doing today, Matt?
Great.
First of all, how did you volunteer for this role? How did this happen where you got to chair this committee?
Well, Speaker Chatfield called and told me that he had appointed me. That was how I found out. So that was it, and then he told me the other members, and I think we've got a great team, and we've got real strong members in Julie Calley and Jack O'Malley on the House side, and we've got two very, very talented Democrats, too, in Rep. Guerra and Rep. Tyrone Carter, and you know, these are people I've worked with very well in the House, and then, you know, our vice chair, Eric Nesbitt, and also, you know, on the Democrat side, Curtis Hertel and Senator Ollier, and then got a couple other strong ones, too, on the Senate side. So I'm really excited about it. I think it'll be a great opportunity to work together and try to come up with ideas to make Michigan operate better in the future if there's a similar situation that occurs.
It's got to be pretty flattering to be in charge of a select committee like this of such importance as a freshman.
Well, I was one of the MERS Freshman of the Year nominees. And as you stated at the time, you know, we've been able to take the House Oversight Committee and, in your words, turn it into an agent for change. And so I think if you look at the way we've done that, is that we've worked together with Republicans and Democrats, And we've tried to focus on the issues, you know, like what are the problems? And whether that was Child Protective Services or whether it's cybersecurity for the state of Michigan, we've tackled it in a bipartisan way, and we've made recommendations for legislative change. And if you look, all those bills have been supported broadly in the House by both Republicans and Democrats. So that's the goal here. I'm going to try to do it the same way with this committee that we've done it in the House, and try to work together and come up with solutions for the people of Michigan so we can make government work better for them.
How do you see this select committee meeting going from kind of a logistical standpoint, given that there's a ban on public gatherings? Is this something that's going to have to meet electronically?
Well, we're going to be working on a set of rules with the Senate. Senator Nesbitt and I have been talking, and we're still working out all the logistics. But that's certainly something that's being considered.
Because at some point, you guys...
What I mean is, what's being considered is meeting in person.
Okay, so you prefer to meet in person, and if you were to, let's say, meet in, let's say, the House Appropriations Room, you could stay 6 feet apart and with your 10 members and with staff and have it videotaped, so you wouldn't necessarily have to do it over Zoom or something.
That's certainly something that could be done, yes. And if we did meet in person, it would be using all the social distancing guidelines and practices, and that would be in consultation with advice from the Senate and the House Council. So, you know, that's my preference, but like I said, we're looking at all options, and we're working with the Senate on that.
What's some of the questions you'd like to have answered, just preliminarily, some of the questions you'd like answers to in regard to how the governor's handled the coronavirus pandemic up to now?
Well, I've heard a lot from people that I represent. I think you know that this has really been unprecedented in terms of the amount of communication that I'm receiving on a daily basis from the people of Kalamazoo and Calhoun counties. So a lot of those questions are really what we need answered. And it's things like the unemployment system and in our state. I mean, you probably know that they failed an audit before any of this happened. And it was actually my intent to take that issue up in the House committee before all of this happened, because there were like 26% of phone calls being dropped then in good economic times. And if you look at the audit, the solution that they said was, well, we came up with this chat function and that's going to solve all of our problems. And so unfortunately in this situation it didn't. So the unemployment system is certainly an area that we need to look into and try to understand what can we do better. I get it that they might not be able to prepare for a surge like what's happened, where, you know, over a quarter of the people are in the workforce are on unemployment, but I'm sure there's some things we can find, you know, working with them, listening, and working with our partners in the Senate. There are things that we can figure out that will help them to operate more effectively, efficiently, and maybe even right now, there are some things they can do to make this a smoother process for the people who are trying to get through.
What do you think the governor's done well up to now in response to this COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, I certainly think that she's done a good job of listening to the legislature on schools. I thought we came to a very good bipartisan agreement there that was allowing local districts to make decisions for their communities and allowing online learning if they want it. I've worked with her on the issue of trying to get a clarity on these expired driver's licenses and expired vehicle registrations. I found her office to be responsive when I reached out on that issue. They kept me in the loop on what they were doing, and ultimately the governor decided to do it. And so I was, you know, very pleased, and I publicly thanked her. Those are two areas I think that she's handled very well.
You mentioned the UIA situation. Is there anything else that you think that just preliminarily that you think she could or the administration in general could improve on?
Well, I think another thing is trying to get trust out there with the public. So, you know, the people that I represent, they are confused a little bit about testing. They're, you know, why is it that some people think we have enough testing materials and other people don't? You know, why is it that people keep getting added on these lists after the fact? And, you know, you remember there was one day where they added 30 people and then they explained, oh, wait, no, we're taking that off because it was last week. So what I'm hoping is that we can work together to get accurate information out there to the public, you know, to get, you know, let's understand what are the assumptions being made behind a lot of these decisions. And I think it'll really give an opportunity, if done right, to get this real information out there, so there's confidence that in the data and confidence in the information they're getting from government. And then we'll certainly enter these things with an open mind and with the intent to solve problems, and we'll just go where those things lead. But I do want you to know I reached out to every committee member, and I've asked them for their list of ideas too. And that includes all of the Democrats. So I want to understand where they want to take this to. I mean, if you look at like Tyrone Carter, you know, he's somebody that's had this. He's somebody who has a really interesting perspective on it. So I want to hear their ideas. You know, they're probably hearing different issues in their communities. It's a geographically diverse committee. And then we'll put together a plan on an order of tackling issues.
And that was going to be my next question. If you saw this oversight as a committee that was actually going to pass legislation or bring subjects to light, or what exactly you saw the purpose of this select committee?
Well, it's similar to my House Oversight Committee. So what we do is we have hearings, we meet with department, we listen to their suggestions, we listen to what they've been doing, you know, to understand why they do things the way they do. And then we work together with, you know, with the different legislators, and we come up with recommendations. So what I think you'll see is that this committee will issue a report with recommendations. And my hope is that some of those will be legislative recommendations. And my hope is that we can start on those bills that this committee recommends this year.
Very good. Matt Hall, he's the new chair of this select legislative committee overseeing COVID-19. Anything else you want to share with our listeners here before I let you go?
No, I'm just looking forward to digging into the issues and working with the Senate to help get answers and to make better policies for the people of Michigan.
Thank you much. Joining me now on the other end of the line is Republican political consultant Scott Hagerstrom. He was also the chair of the Donald Trump campaign back in 2016. How are you doing today, Scott?
Great. Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. So there is a court case that's going on right now that is of very particular interest to our readers, and this has to do with the lawsuit filed by Eric Asaki in the 11th District of Congress, in which a judge agreed with him and lowered the number of signatures a congressional candidate has to file and cut it in half, moved the filing deadline out a couple weeks, and then also allowed for electronic signatures. Now, you have been opposed to this decision and been fighting it, but over the weekend here, it looks like you guys were dealt another blow.
Yeah, I think it was really a blow for the rule of law. It was a blow for citizens here in Michigan. You know, the governor had the power to change that, and she chose not to. The legislature had the power to pass legislation and hold hearings and chose not to. But yet this judge, an Obama appointee, activist judge, and the plaintiff, Eric Asaki, who the ACLU joined in to support, asked the judge to change and basically to make law. The reason Eric Asaki, a Republican, won is because he was lucky to get the draw of a very activist judge.
So my understanding then is there was an appeal that the judge came back with over the weekend and said no to. What's the next step here for this case as far as you're concerned?
You know, I think with the timing and everything, I'm not sure, you know, that there's going to be any changes. You know, I understand that saying the signature deadline to May 8th. But again, the governor had the power to do that, and she chose not to, as did the legislature. And reducing the number of signatures is very concerning, just because, you know, 1,000 signatures, valid signatures, is a very low threshold. And it just shows that you have support within the community. So that was, you know, what's interesting is the candidate that filed the lawsuit ended up filing 1,200 signatures just a few days before the deadline. He was on with the judge and talking personally about why this needed to happen, why he couldn't get his signatures. And then suddenly 5 days later, he has 1,200 signatures. So that's very interesting. The other part of this ruling is with the electronic signatures, which is very, very concerning. Electronic signature, it could be very open to fraud. Basically, the Secretary of State's office, the Elections Division, wrote the rules for this. There's no legislative oversight. You know, someday we will have electronic signatures as part of the process, but not going through the proper legislative hearings, bringing in experts, and designing a system that can prevent fraud is very concerning.
Well, let's talk about that, because we do have a group that is trying to get the LGBT community recognized in the Larson Civil Rights Act, and they're passing around petitions right now. And because of the governor's stay safe, stay home order, they're not able to collect signatures at festivals and large events like they would normally. And so they're going this electronic signature route, and they're going through a very exhaustive process in which they're using a certified company, and they're requiring that you got to put in your driver's license number. They're going that far. So, I mean, it seems like, you know, if they follow the proper procedures, what's wrong with it?
Well, they're proper procedures. I'm not sure, you know, whose proper procedures is it that they're following. There's been no legislative hearings, no oversight, no discussion, no real political discussion about how do we design a system to prevent fraud. And, you know, it has nothing to do with the issue. It just has to do with the integrity of the system.
So you're saying that without rules, this group is kind of flying by what they think is appropriate, and that may not be really what proper in the eyes of the law.
Exactly. I know there's, you know, in the past, the legislation was introduced actually to go from a legal size sheet to an 8.5 by 11, so that there could be an attempt to communicate with citizens across the state and to email them the form that could print off, sign it, and send it in. That legislation was never passed into law. That would have made the process a little bit easier. There are several other things that have gone through the legislature but have not made it into law. So what we're saying is that this is very concerning, because the judge gave the Secretary of State 72 hours to write rules to deal with electronic signatures. But again, the Secretary of State does not make law, neither should the judge be making law. So this sets a very dangerous precedent. So I hope that the legislature does look at this issue, does hold hearings, and we can design a system that is not open to fraud and protects the integrity of our election system.
So, Scott, you're working with Whitney Williams in the 11th District, Christina Like in the 8th District, and a few other candidates, I understand. Give me your lay of the land here on both of those districts, because the prevailing wisdom is that they're both trending Democratic, and they're both long shots for the Republicans this year.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back to 16, we learned that prevailing wisdom doesn't necessarily hold up. With Donald Trump's candidacy, I think a lot of things were thrown out the window in terms of all the political experts and political consultants and what would happen with the Trump presidency, or the possibility of Trump becoming president. So both of these districts are marginally Republican districts. We always knew with President Trump as the top of the ticket for the Republican, as the incumbent, that things would be very interesting this year. And with the whole COVID situation, COVID-19, they got a lot more interesting. And then we see this oil price war between Russia and Saudi Arabia, and the collapse of oil prices, and now the high unemployment rate. There's a lot of moving parts, But we do know that this is a target for the president's campaign for Republicans here in Michigan. There's going to be a lot of activity. And if President Trump has showed Republicans anything, it's how to fight and how to get in the battle and how to win these battles. So I would not count Republicans out at all. and it's going to be a very interesting year.
What do you think President Trump has done right in regards to his response to COVID-19?
I think he's had a very open discussion. He's very hands-on. I could never see previous presidents being so involved. Of course, the president only sleeps a few hours a night. He's a workaholic. He's constantly looking at things. And sure, he has a very open and thoughtful process that he engages in when he holds the press conferences. But that's why you have to listen to every word he says, because I think a lot of things are taken out of context with the media in terms of some of the things he says. But listening to Mark Cuban, who's no fan of President Trump, he brought up the fact, listen, I'm not going to throw him under the bus. This is all new. This is new to everyone. No other politicians were standing up and screaming. You know, it seems like with President Trump, he can never do anything right. He closes the border, or he closes immigration and travel from China, and he's criticized as a racist. But then a few weeks later, they're saying he didn't do enough soon enough. So, you know, it seems like the other side of the left wants to have it both ways. I think the president has taken very measured steps. Again, you know, our governors, our president, this is a very new situation, and they're dealing with it the best that they can.
All right. Scott Hagerstrom, Republican political consultant and former 2016 Trump Michigan director. Appreciate your time today.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. I'd like to thank AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Thanks to the Governor, Gretchen Whitmer, Representative Matt Hall, and Scott Hagerstrom. For the crew here at MERS, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.